fourth case for today, United States versus Suimio.
Good
morning.
It's not only a pleasure to be here to present it on it. I've been sitting here watching the other three arguments, and it's a pleasure to listen to the arguments and the questions of the court, too. It's better than anything on TV or any place else. This is a very simple issue. We're arguing over one point. The trial court, the government said the defendant pled early enough to get the one point. They told that to the trial judge. The defendant tried to plead about a week and a half before. The judge was too busy, too occupied, didn't want to hear it. The government was right the first time, and they have no ability to argue differently in this court.
Why does that week make such a difference to the court's evaluation of how her time was being used? She was very convinced that this was not a timely plea, and I didn't see anything in the transcript to make me think she would have thought it was timely if it had been 8 days earlier.
She's wrong. She's absolutely wrong.
She's evaluating the convenience to the court. How can she be wrong?
Because there was other people in the same indictment who was going to be tried. So it made no difference if he pled a week or 2 weeks beforehand. There was going to be a trial.
You don't think the government prepares separately for different defendants?
As to the government's preparation, the government has not changed its position that they didn't have to prepare for him.
And you don't think the court has a greater burden when it's a three-defendant trial than a two-defendant trial?
Not at all. It's a sham. You know, I was going to say this for rebuttal, and I'm going to say it now, and I'm going to walk away, and if somebody wants to hold me in contempt, well, so be it. I'm going to tell you a story. It's in a state court down at the Daly Center. A judge is riding down an elevator. Some people get on the elevator. They don't know then that some lawyers get on the elevator, and they do not know that the judge is there, and they're talking about the judge, and they're saying that he's arrogant and dictatorial, and so just all in himself.
A description that would apply to most judges, right?
What? No, I'm not saying that. The judge goes home and he says to his wife, you know, Your Honor, I was coming down in the elevator and these gentlemen lawyers were there. They didn't know I was there and they said I was arrogant and dictatorial. I'm not that way, am I, hon? And she says, no, Your Honor. Thank you. That's my argument.
Mr. Handelsman, back again with us.
I don't think I can do better than Mr. Cohen. I'd like to correct an arithmetical mistake in my brief. I became a lawyer because I wasn't very good in math. Page 16, when I tried to do a calculation, 30% of 100 grams is not 300, it's 30. I know I have the same problem when I get my checking account statement every month, but that would take the figures way, way down. Should be 130 grams per week multiplied by 5 months or 22 weeks. Only to address the issues raised in the government's brief and the reply brief. The first is whether the pro se objections to the PSR were sufficient to avoid the government's plain error contention. Judge Conlon recognized the nature of the objections. She said it had to do with the amount of the heroin attributed to Mr. Thomas. And it said essentially the same thing the district court said in Jones. And when she made her decision, she said the evidence in the case essentially established you're accountable for more than 10 kilograms. She obviously would have reached the same result, made the same decision, said the same thing if he made the precise objection I raised in the appellate briefs. On the merits, Judge Conlon was required to use the most conservative figures to calculate the quantity. The government points out she used one conservative figure, 5 months. That doesn't mean that she followed your cases, which require all figures to be the most conservative shown by the evidence. Argument 3 of the brief raised an issue which I've raised in 2 other appeals, one under advisement here. The government has not contested that, as whether Apprendi takes away the district judge's determination of quantities under clear error rule. We submit that it does not. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Robbins.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Matthew Robinson on behalf of the appellant, Cornell Green. In this particular action, appeal, we're basically appealing the government's refusal to file a 5K1 departure at sentencing based upon Mr. Green's substantial assistance to the authorities. We're looking at an individual who received a 30-year sentence, who's pleaded guilty, accepted responsibility, forfeited over $1 million in assets to the government, and provided substantial assistance to the government. And the third part, the substantial assistance, is what we're talking about here. This is not disputed. Not disputed by the government that Mr. Green provided essential testimony at the trial of Robert Thomas that resulted in his conviction. Additionally, as a result of Mr. Green's assistance, a co-defendant had pleaded guilty. The problem lies when the defendant, Mr. Green, stopped continuing to assist the government just prior to sentencing.
So, Mr. Robinson, you've argued that the reason he did that had to do with concerns for family safety and so on, but the government responds that this was not something that ever made its way into the record at the district court. And aside from one very uninformative offhand reference to family at the sentencing, I not that I know the record as well as you do, but I didn't see it there. Can you help out on that?
I can only help out in that that it was mentioned at sentencing that he was concerned for his family's welfare.
He just said but mostly for family or something?
Yes, and I agree with you, that is a very vague allegation, and the record does not give us a lot to argue with regard to this particular point. But I think the point remains that he did provide substantial assistance, that one of the government's arguments here is that this was a material breach by the defendant when he, although he answered questions regarding additional cases, the government stated that he wasn't being truthful, or I'm not sure what the...
Well, he kind of shut off his cooperation, didn't he, about 2 weeks before the trial?
Yes, approximately 2 weeks before the trial, before his sentencing.
Yeah.
But I don't think I'm arguing that that is not a material breach. And one of the cases that we relied upon, the U.S. v. Arnold, basically states that when there are serious equitable reasons why someone is not as forthcoming as the government would like, that doesn't necessarily preclude a downward departure or preclude the government from filing for a downward departure when the defendant has already provided substantial assistance. There's no question here that he has done that, and I think that's the essence of our argument. There's no question that he had provided substantial assistance in this case, and the plea agreement itself was entered into upon an agreement or an understanding on the part of the defendant, Mr. Green, that if he cooperated, that if he testified, that if he provided substantial assistance that resulted in the prosecution and the conviction of other individuals, that he would be rewarded in part for that assistance. Now, I think where the government does have a point here. He did stop. But I think that is a factor that the judge, the sentencing court, should have taken into account and the extent of departure that it could give under 5K1.1. The government also argues that the defendant waived this argument at sentencing. I do dispute that. I think that a waiver is a little strong here. He did not intentionally relinquish a right here. There was discussion at the sentencing hearing about his cooperation, and I think that is sufficient to show that there is a record of cooperation in this matter, and a departure should have been granted. And if there are no further questions, I'll...
Thank you, Mr. Robinson.
Thank you.
Mr. John?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Let me first address Appellant Solomimo's appeal. And there really only is one issue there, and that is the third point for acceptance of responsibility. And Your Honor hit the nail right on the head. The question here is, from the court's perspective, was there a saving of resources? And quite clearly, Judge Tomlin decided that there was no such saving, and there is nothing in the record to indicate that if the plea had taken place 5, 6, 7, 8 days ahead of trial, that the finding would have been any different. The fact of the matter is the defendant waited until the trial had commenced and only pleaded guilty after the first full day of trial. And as the record makes clear, Judge Conlon had to take time away from her otherwise busy schedule late in the day at the end of the first day of trial to engage in a plea colloquy.
But of course, the government was still prepared to recommend that third point.
We were, Judge. We were, Judge. The applicable guideline is drafted in the conjunctive. So the fact of the matter is the government's position is really of no moment, given that the court's finding was based upon a determination of its own resources and the fact that its resources were not saved by the tardiness of the plea. With regard to Defendant Thomas's appeal, again, one issue, the drug quantity determination, the court did, in fact, make a very conservative determination based upon all of the available evidence. And that evidence basically fit into a fairly straightforward formula. The number of days that the defendant was a participant in this conspiracy multiplied by the amount of heroin that was moved by the conspiracy and that was reasonably foreseeable to the defendant on a daily basis. The court took all of the available information, including evidence of the statements, the two different statements that Defendant Thomas himself gave to law enforcement authorities, and then extrapolated from that information to arrive at a very conservative drug quantity calculation that was well in excess of the threshold amount needed to sentence the defendant under the offense level that he was sentenced at. That's the methodology that has been approved by this court, specifically in the PIGE, P-I-G-double-E decision. Finally, with regard to Defendant Green, the record is clear that the defendant, as counsel indicated, ceased his cooperation. Turns out it was about 5 or 6 or 7 weeks before his sentencing, but after he had testified, the government concedes truthfully at the trial of two other defendants. What's important to recognize here is that the plea agreement required the defendant to provide full and complete and truthful cooperation with regard to any matter that he was asked to cooperate about. So the fact that he may have provided partial albeit truthful cooperation did not in fact discharge his obligation under the clear terms of the plea agreement. Once he failed to satisfy that obligation, the government therefore was not required in its own right to go forward with a downward departure motion.
But what are we to make of the district court's comments at the sentencing? He wanted a little bit more time, right? He wanted a continuance, and the district court said, no, I don't want to do that, but you could resume, I suppose, cooperation.
Right, but Judge Conlon did not shut the door on the possibility of a downward departure motion under what would be Rule 35 motion.
Sure.
In fact, she
sure.
essentially invited such a motion, and she encouraged, I think, implicitly the defendant to continue his cooperation by indicating that she would entertain such a motion if it were brought by the government.
Are we still within that time period? What day was he?
Judge, I think the sentencing was September 14th of 2001. I'm not sure when the judgment commitment order was docketed, but
okay.
We are probably beyond that time period. The fact of the matter is the defendant did not seize on that invitation, that proposal, and has not come back in and sought to continue his cooperation. The cooperation that was asked of the defendant was the essence of this agreement. It was clearly material, and it's the only reason the government entered into the agreement in the first place. The government wanted his cooperation, it wanted his full cooperation, it got partial cooperation, and therefore could not, under the terms of the agreement, have any obligation to make the downward departure motion. There was no explanation given whatsoever as to why that cooperation ceased when it did cease. And in any event, the obligation on the defendant's part to cooperate was not qualified in any way. Had the defendant indicated that there were reasons underlying his decision to terminate his cooperation, maybe they could have been dealt with, but they were never brought forth, and they're certainly not in the record. Judges, unless there are further questions, I would simply request that this court affirm the convictions of the defendant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Ms. Cohen?
The government
There is no explanation from the judge as to why it disrupted her activities. It was very clear the defendant wanted to plead for a long time in, and the only dispute was what the amount of drugs he's going to be responsible for, which can be resolved when a person pleads guilty and there's still a plea and still that be a dispute. She didn't really like that. She didn't like to have to resolve anything for, if there's going to be a plea. And to say that he didn't plead until the end of the first day of trial, he tried to plead that morning. He tried, the record's clear, he tried to plead a week and a week and a half before. And his lawyer and the U.S. attorney, and the record shows us, contacted the judge's staff and tried to arrange a plea, if not before her, before some other judge. And clearly, if a judge is, and also when the government at the trial level said, we think he should have the recommendation, they were saying it based on their situation and the judge's situation. They took a position. They shouldn't be able to change that position here. There's no basis. And as waiver applies to the defense again and again and again, waiver has to apply to the government. In this case, if a judge is going to say, well, I was disrupted, where there doesn't seem to be anything in the record which would indicate any type of disruption, clearly the judge should have to explain how she was disrupted, how him not having him in the beginning of the trial, where there are other defendants going to trial, would cause a disruption of her time. Judges are like anybody else. If they're going to take a position, they have to explain it. It wasn't explained. This case should be reversed. I should go to a different judge for sentence.
Let me ask you this. In Wisconsin, in the district court, I know they have a rule to get to 3 points instead of two in a more than 16-level case. The judges ordinarily set a cutoff date in these multi-defendant cases. If you plead guilty before that date, you can get 3 points, acceptance of responsibilities, assuming everything is fine. But if you miss that date, you don't get it. Is there any rule like that in the Northern District?
No.
It's just up to whatever the individual judge wants
right.
to do.
The individual judges set dates like that.
Individual judges may set dates, but they don't even set dates consistently with regards to, you know, in every case it has to be before 3 weeks, 2 weeks, 5 weeks before it goes to trial. Judges set dates arbitrarily. In different cases. In this case, the defendant had a lawyer and then another lawyer, the lawyer below when he pled guilty was appointed because there was a great disagreement with the other lawyer and difficulty. And so the court found it was appropriate to appoint a new lawyer. The defendant shouldn't be punished for the fact, you know, he needs an interpreter, he can't speak properly, and he gets a new lawyer appointed. There was a problem with the second lawyer working it out. As the government's position was at the lower level that he did everything to get the third point, he should get it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Mr. Handelman? You have 1 minute, Mr. Handelman.
Judge Conlon did not use the most conservative figures. A probation officer found a lot more than what Green testified to. I'm a little bit confused myself. I think Green's testimony is on pages 42 and 43 of the transcript. He said he bought 100 grams once to three times a week and added the filler. I think I gave you the wrong figure before on the filler. The initial figures may be correct, but regardless of that, she did not use the most conservative figures. She had to use, certainly without a credibility determination, she had to use the figures that Green gave her, which were a lot less than what the probation officer found. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Robinson?
Your Honors, the appellant's position here, obviously, is that the government must live up to its agreements, particularly when it involves a defendant waiving significant constitutional rights and pleading guilty. This is a contractual claim, obviously. By way of analogy, I would just simply say that this is along the lines of someone buying a home, and when they get into the home, they find that there's a minor defect in the home that needs fixed. Now, obviously, that doesn't, stop the selling of the home. The home is still sold. And there may be some sort of recourse from the person who sold the home to the buyer. This is similar to that. In this case, there's no question a downward departure should have been moved for by the government. Substantial assistance was rendered. The assistance was not as complete as the government wanted. And with that, I would ask for a remand for resentencing so that we could have that.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Thanks to Mr. Handelsman and Mr. Cohen for their representation in the court. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.